Hello, I'm Elena Del Val, and this is the HispanicNPR.com podcast. My guest today is Eduardo Siegel, who is author of Resisting Recession, How to Build and Preserve Your Real Estate Investments Regardless of Market Conditions. We will discuss how to master the real estate mindset. Eduardo is a seasoned real estate investor and entrepreneur. His philosophy focuses on stable income, dependable cash flow, and economic strength, particularly in uncertain economic times. Drawing from decades of family expertise and his own successful career, he empowers investors to build resilient intergenerational wealth, according to his bio. As the founder of Signet Investments and host of the Signet podcast, Eduardo champions a long-term approach that prioritizes safety, growth, and sustainability, offering strategies for thriving amidst market volatility. Eduardo, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat with you today.
Let's start with a conflict of interest statement, if you would.
Okay. This is, a discussion, and I guess my interest is just here for myself and for enjoyment to discuss my book. And not sponsored by anybody, and happy to be here.
Wonderful. Thank you. What do we mean by the real estate mindset?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, I've seen people, I started real estate when I was 12 years old, and I've seen different generations sort of approach real estate, get invested, manage properties, buy properties. And to me, it's so interesting how people go into real estate. You know, everybody wants to make money. I mean, that's obvious. But different people go in for different reasons. And I see the difference between the successful ones and the ones that are just in it to have assets. You know, I think one sets you up for failure and then one sets you up for success. And the reason I believe mindset is so important is because it's important to take a step back from all the numbers, from, you know, all the hot topics that are maybe setting people up for disaster, and think about why you want to invest in the first place. You know, what's the long-term strategy? And you got to ask yourself, what mindset do I need to start with? And people don't ask that question. And so I've seen some very successful people make a lot of money, and they think very differently, almost contradictory. I was going to call the book that I wrote ironically contradictory, because it's ironic how different success is with a different mindset, with the right mindset that I don't see as very commonplace these days.
What is the right mindset?
Well, what I was saying, everybody wants to make money. It's true, but people prioritize quick returns over stability and over position. You know, position has a huge value in real estate. Real estate has cycles. And it's funny to me how people forget that things go up and go down in real estate. Everybody thinks real estate's just a good investment. They don't talk about the, it's like Vegas. Everybody comes back from Vegas, you know, either a winner or a liar. And in real estate, nobody talks about the losses they had. And there's a lot of devastation that happens in real estate. Going into it with the right mindset, positioning yourself and your investments in a way that protects you, there's a value to that. And that's part of the mindset. Do you want stability in the future, or do you just want high returns? People that consider, you know, all of their goals, stability, their position, being able to sleep at night. I think those kinds of things are the ingredients that create a very long-term successful real estate investor and a happier life.
What kind of real estate are we referring to here? Is it...
So I guess that's, you know, with mindset, that's kind of where I... One of the reasons why I love talking about mindset so much. We live in a culture of impulsiveness, and instant gratification. And real estate, I've seen, especially with the crowdfunding craze that happened from the 2014 Jobs Act, people prioritize getting quick returns. And a lot of these deals made sense on paper, but a lot of these deals were fabricated with great returns. And the truth is that a lot of new 25% of new investors were in 2022 were, individuals, crowdfunded funds. These are new people in real estate who may have had a lot of expertise in their business. Maybe they were a dentist. Maybe they were, in another business that wasn't real estate, but they didn't necessarily understand these things in real estate, the mindset, stability, negotiation strength. Low leverage is a priority for a lot of people that are successful too, because you never know when you're going to have a vacancy. Sometimes your tenants will use that as leverage, and you don't want to lose that leverage because you have a huge mortgage to pay every month. So that's kind of the mindset. These are topics that I discuss in my book that, I feel a savvy investor needs to pay attention to if they want to have the wherewithal to last.
What kind of real estate are we talking about here? Is this residential, commercial, industrial, office?
Well, I mean, I think that an investor needs to understand all of whatever they're investing in, they need to understand. Industrial is a very different from retail, let's say, very different from residential. This applies to everything. That's why I love going into it with such a broad topic, mindset, because it's really about where you want, how you want to position your future risks and what you want to sort of minimize. The idea of resisting recession, the name of my book, is really about trying to protect yourself during cycles and to capitalize on cycles.
Right now, with all of the stock market swings that are taking place right now, high highs, low lows, the almost a bear market, everything that's happening right now, in addition to the real estate bubble that many experts are referring to, it seems like an odd time to jump into investing in real estate. Do you think that it matters based on what you're saying when you jump in? Does it matter when in the cycle?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's it's a fun question to ask because there's so many different ways to look at it. The truth is, good properties tend to not be distressed sales. So sometimes if you find a good property in a great location, then you're not gonna then in the long run, it's good to buy if you buy it right. Even in good times, it's you have those assets to get them in the first place is huge. Money mostly is not made during the good times. It's made during the volatile times. That's when opportunity is. So it really depends on the goal. I think that the question, in a way, it's a fun sort of question to ask, but it really depends on what you're buying and when you're buying it and what's going on with the trends in the area. It's very hard to find a good deal, but when you do, you don't want to lose it because it's a bad time to buy or the market's hot or whatever.
At the same time, if it's a bubble and you put your money in the bubble when it's going up, then when it comes down, you could potentially lose whatever you have risked. Is that right?
Yeah, but it depends. I think that people generally buy to hold for a while, to cash flow, to increase value. It is kind of, to me, it is a little bit trepidatious to go into an investment when the market is too hot. But at the same time, if you buy something in a great area, prices don't if you have the ability to hold and you position yourself in a way to be able to hold, it minimizes a lot of risks. My dad, I've worked with my dad. I grew up, that's kind of why I got started in real estate. He took me under his wing at a very young age. He would always talk about, like, what's the exit plan? If you have a condo development, let's say, or even a house, okay, if you can't Airbnb it, are you going to rent it? Is the rent still going to cover the mortgage? If you can't rent it, are you going to sell it? If you maybe you convert it into a hotel. I mean, every property has its own benefits and its own flexibility, but you have to have other plans and other plans for income. And it's important. A lot of the time, people just think of one plan. It's important to think for three plans, just because you got to stay nimble in a changing, market.
Give us an example. For instance, here in Florida, there is a condo crisis, as some of the reports have described it, where a lot of condo owners are selling at a loss, or certainly at a big discount from what they might have purchased for it, in what some might consider a very advantageous market, and yet it's potentially high risk. Is that a good opportunity? Is that a too high a risk? What would you say about that?
Yeah, I think that it's a good opportunity now, possibly. To me, for the last 5, 8 years, people have been paying too much for properties. And I think that it was a bad position to get in, because when you overpay for a property, it becomes very hard to make up for that. My family's been in real estate for, I don't know, since the 1980s. We've seen different cycles. And when the market's hot, there tends to be a lot more corporations buying. And corporations have a different mindset. A lot of the time, they get paid management fees just for having assets. So their motivations might not be to make, a certain percentage return than a family office, let's say, which for your viewers just basically means that, you have a very small investment, group, and you're going in basically for the returns, and you don't have sort of shareholders besides your family or a small group of people to that you're responsible for. It's a different structure. So to me, that's a different animal. And a lot of these condo build outs that are happening, that they happen all over the country, it's yeah, they're getting into trouble, but some of them can convert into rentals, which that's a backup plan. But since, in my opinion, if anybody pays more than they should, then there is trouble brewing. And when interest rates go up, that's where people sometimes really can't afford it anymore. There is this huge strategy, and in a way, the mind said not the mindset the value that it brought to I guess the public was good. It was called the Burr method, and the idea was buy, repair, rent, refinance, and that's what the BRRR stood for. And it was a good idea. People would start buying properties. They would rent them out, maybe Airbnb, maybe rent them as rentals. After repairing, they'd increase the value. They'd go to refinance, and what they found was when they would refinance, a lot of times they wouldn't qualify for that second loan, or they would qualify, but it would be a hard money loan, which those types of loans are probably 3 to 4% more in the interest. And they would be stuck, and they wouldn't be able to afford it, and they wouldn't be able to, build their portfolio that way. And when interest rates went up, a lot of these people really had a hard time holding on to those assets. Why? Because they maybe spent too much money. And that's the issue. It's about not getting yourself into trouble. The thing about wealth, I believe the top 1%, only 9% of the top 1% stay in the 1% for more than, I think it was 3 to 5 years. It's very easy to lose money. So it's not only about making money, but it's about keeping it and growing it and sort of stabilizing the long-term sort of, value of building your portfolio.
Markets are constantly changing, so that real estate in one period, say you were talking about the 1980s, may be different than in another period, say around the great financial crisis, 2006, 2009. And now there's been a lot of changes in the way that people buy real estate, finance real estate, what they do with the real estate, as well as the other people who are competing in that space. So when you go to buy a property, the investors are different than they might have been, say, in the 1980s. Now, if you're looking to buy a property, even as a home, you might be competing with a publicly traded, very well-funded company. Tell us a little bit about those circumstances.
Yeah, no, it's a different ball game. I think that in a way that gets over exaggerated. I was doing some research on statistics and, BlackRock owning all these residential homes. I don't think it's as, it affects the market as much as people say it does. To me, oftentimes, corporations are not, let's say, interested in buying a single home in the middle of a residential neighborhood. I think usually they're in the business of having a lot of rentals in a pocket or, a certain neighborhood. To me, it's not something that that's a huge issue. I mean, there's no doubt that there's trouble in housing, but I don't necessarily think it's due to corporate investment.
Because they represent a small percent of the market, the corporate ownership, is that what you mean?
Yeah, I don't think it's as big as people make it out to be. There are issues, and there are issues with pricing. There's issues with supply. There's issues with construction costs and affordability, for sure. I mean, that's a major that's a problem. But corporate investment, let's say you're an individual and you want to buy a house, and now you're competing with BlackRock or other bigger corporations. I don't see that happening. And as a broker, because I also do brokerage, and my friends are brokers, so I see a lot of action on the street. I don't see that happening.
Where should someone start? Should they start on their own? Should they buy shares in a company that's investing in real estate? Should they team up with a family member or a friend?
I love that question. It's funny because I have a friend who's a money manager, and on my podcast, I asked him a similar question, and he was describing how an individual, everybody is so different. And you can really appreciate how to build somebody's portfolio, their plan, their strategy, like tailor-made to what their goals are. First, it depends on their capacity to purchase. If people need to understand how much capital they have, how many properties they would want to divide that capital in. Some people don't have a ton of capital. It costs a lot of money to just get into real estate. So a good way to sort of buy a lot of properties is to bring a big group together, not a big group, but maybe five people together that are close friends, or that have similar economic objectives, and start discussing what kind of deals they might be interested in and why. And also, once you do that, you build a little pool of money, then to see how to finance. So financing is very favorable for, individual homes. So maybe that's one way to start. But financing is huge. In my opinion, people shouldn't be looking into real estate unless they know how much they could borrow. And although I say that low leverage is better, still having leverage matters. And when you're starting out and you have limited resources, understanding how much you can borrow, your buying power, that is, that's an extremely important ingredient in knowing where to find what to look at.
Should you be looking at residential? Should you be looking at loftier goals in residential? How do you decide where to position your investment, even if you pool your money with other like-minded colleagues or family members? How do you decide based on these goals that you're saying to position yourself for growth, I think you're saying, right?
Yeah, it's a good question because it really depends. One thing that got me into writing this book and having this podcast that I used to do pretty often. I always remember when I started it, my uncles, two dentists, were looking for a piece of real estate, and we found them a McDonald's. I believe it was, I don't know if it was in the East Coast, but it was a perfect deal for them because they were dentists. They wanted to be hands off, and the idea was that they would buy a property. McDonald's would pay down their mortgage, and when McDonald's lease was up, the market, the rent, it was an appreciating area that the rents were going up, so they would have double the rent or triple the rent, depending whatever market was in 15 years. And that would be their retirement. And I guess to answer it, your question differently is keeping it simple. A house might be more management than commercial. It depends on the individual deal. I think that maybe discussing each type of real estate would be important. McDonald's is that example. It's a very simple investment. McDonald's, usually retail tenants tend to maintain their own property. They cover all the property taxes. It's called the triple net lease. I mean, of course, every lease is different, but in commercial, it's kind of simple in terms of that. And it's you don't really have a lot of management, so that might be a great solution. My uncles don't have real estate besides their own homes. And that was a very great investment opportunity for them long term, very hands off. Residential can be a lot of work. A lot of people are talking about buying houses, and now with the prices going up, renting out individual rooms, because that might be a great way to maximize the income of a particular investment. The problem with that is that there could be a lot of headaches. It's a lot of management, that's no doubt. But that might not be for everybody. That might be for someone who's very energetic, who's willing to be going back and forth to the property and check on everything all the time, and hire cleaning people, and it's a lot of it could be a lot of headache depending on the area too. It could be something where there is potential, tenants that show up short term that don't like each other, and then there's drama. So it depends what people want to do. The McDonald's, you might not make as high a return. It's not sexy. It's just, it's like collecting a bond, which nothing wrong with a bond, but it doesn't have the ups and down swings that, residential might. Residential also, you have all sorts of issues. You can have mold, you have rodent. There's a lot of upkeep. There's a lot of complications that come with that. So I think just understanding everything. I mean, this is why I like to meet new clients, because you talk about what their goals are, what they want to avoid, even what their future family plans are, because that has a huge impact. Do they want to make the money, within the next 5 to 10 years for their returns, or do they want to pay down loan and leave an estate for their kids? If they do leave an estate, is it something that's going to be more like a bond, or are the kids responsible and they want to hand them over something that's going to, require more management? Some people have kids that do have sort of alcoholism or aren't interested in business. And it's a different, it's a different strategy for everybody.
Right. Now there are property taxes that are in the limelight in some circumstances because of lawsuits. There have been lawsuits that brought out unfair taxing. And now that there's also high homeowners association and condo association fees run amok in some cases, as with the condos here in Florida, and insurance costs that have also gotten out of control. What weight should you give to these issues? Because all three of those are playing a big role in the real estate market right now.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question, and I'm writing it down. Taxes, insurance, and HOA. God, everything's getting so expensive these days. It's true. It's a lot of stress, and it's just where our country's going. I think that it feels like, it feels that we're in a healthy economic environment. They've been telling us that for the last 5 years, and things are getting more expensive. This is why I think financial planning and is so important, because and this is also why resisting recession, preparing for to have a little nest egg of extra resources, I think make a difference with everything changing. And you don't know what things are going to happen. Insurance in Florida, I think in some properties tripled. I'm not certain of the tax legalities there and how they're, most of our properties are in California. Here we're protected by Proposition 13, where they're kind of fixed and they do increase annually, but that the nature of that is very different from, let's say, Texas, where they could reassess the property every 2 years, and then it's almost like a you have to go fight the property taxes and show the county how the value is lower than what they think. They want to increase the value because they get more, a higher tax base, so they could collect more money from the landlords.
It
And it
was in
becomes, you know,
Texas. The case that I heard about was in Texas, by the way.
okay, yeah, that's how it is there. In Colorado, it's the same way. It's becomes a bit of a racket and a bit costly, instead of getting the tax money, you pay the lawyer to argue that the value is lower than, than the county claims. And counties generally are not the best at valuing properties. And values are volatile. So that sort of answers your question, or to discuss it, that you asked a little while ago. The values going up and down. Values go up and down. It's supply and demand. It's what people want and what's there. So one thing that I would tell your audience, I think, and I think it's a valuable comment, and it was said by someone I interviewed, is that money in real estate is made by a supply constraint, and that generally is true. I mean, that's not necessarily just real estate. That's when demand is almost predictable to grow and there's a limited supply of something, gold, let's say, it's a better position to be in than, let's say, you own a destination hotel in the middle of, I don't know, Costa Rica, Oklahoma, anywhere, where you have to market very hard to get your audience in. And there might be a ton of land in Oklahoma, so it's not, it's a different, it's a different supply demand nature of supply and demand. Not that there's anything wrong with Oklahoma, I love it, but it's, those kinds of markets are cash flow markets where, you focus mostly on the annual returns. You don't expect them to appreciate. Markets in let's say Santa Monica, California, certain more limited inventory of real estate, you're going to have a growing population and you're going to have a fixed amount of land that you need to improve, that now you have that sort of position of capitalizing long term.
How much weight should you give to issues beyond the price, such as property taxes, HOA fees, and insurance? Do you just park your money, pay the fees, and hope that your property appreciates? Do you focus on being able to rent and getting a cash flow? Where should your strategy be? Cash flow, appreciation?
Yeah, that's great. Well, let's see. Cash flow and appreciation. I like a mix. That has to do with your plan, I think. You know, depending on what your needs are, what your stomach can handle, because sometimes, you know, the ups and downs with different types of investments are hard for people. I think that, yeah, my father, for example, when we were little, we lived in Texas, very cash flow. Then we moved to LA, very appreciation oriented, very different mindset. What should you focus on? From what I've seen from him, from several other people that I know, it's a combination and it depends on the deal. Appreciation can also come not in the long run, it could come in the short run. We have a property in Carmel by the Sea. And when we went into it, it had a really good yield. It was a 5% yield for retail, which was great, and it came 60% vacant. So we bought it for the income that it had, and then we filled it up, and you know, the income practically doubled. And that appreciation happened immediately because the income happened immediately. So that and but the value went up significantly because of that, and that's, you know, that's the appreciation. That was great because it was and the cash on cash was great. So, but it wasn't a typical cash return type of a deal. So now I think I deviated from your question. Sorry about that. Let's see. So should you so back to the should you focus on taxing, insurance, or HOA and those costs? You know, I feel this is where it's business, and you always have to keep your eyes open. You know, if insurance is about to skyrocket, and you, let's say in Florida, you're having more and more hurricanes, more and more, you know, risks. It depends how much that risk is going to affect the unknowns. There's everything's an unknown. Every, you know, it's funny. You have these economists come on MSNBC all the time, and 90% of the time they're wrong. Nobody knows anything, and you have to be prepared for everything. But there's certain flags, you know, like, you know, taxes in Florida. That might be a hard one to calculate, but HOA fees, you know, another one hard to calculate, and insurance. I guess that's hard to calculate also. Chances are Florida's insurance is not going to go down. I would expect it to go up. So yeah, I think that's something worth thinking about. Taxes, there, I don't feel the counties and the state is gonna make it impossible for landlords to own properties. So I feel like you wouldn't expect that to go up so much unless, you know, there's some kind of county assessment. But that's something I would feel is not a low risk. And then the HOA fees, another one. I think that understanding what they're doing in the you know, how they're governing, if there's any capital that's required for the overall community, it's important to know because sometimes there's major improvements that a building needs, and there's major, you know, special assessments that you need $70,000, $150,000 to fix plumbing that hasn't been deferred for the last 20 years, or you know, there's different things. So knowing those things, you know, do make a difference. And yeah, I think you have to know everything. I mean, in a way, it's this is why I don't believe in passive, the term passive income, because nothing's passive. You have to know everything. You have to know your taxes. You have to know what's going on in the world and how it affects, you know, your investments. And it's a very active thing to do, even if it's, you know, even if it's passive by accounting or legal or, you know, standards.
What do you mean with your philosophy that you talk about in the book of buying the position and not the return?
Yeah, that goes back to where I talk about buying stable assets. and not assets that you think will make a high yield. There's two things I think about that. The first thing is with crowdfunding, a lot of people were looking at the IRR return. They were looking, which is the internal rate of return. It's a way to calculate, the juice your dollar will get you, I guess. The problem with that is it's very easy to chase after high returns and make things look, make the numbers look pretty on something that could happen. The reality is that those numbers don't always come to fruition, and that number sometimes can be tricky because it's based on a sale that happens very soon. Well, if the sale doesn't happen, the return's not good. It could change the IRR. Buying a position, it doesn't mean not caring about, your return, yield, whatever you want to call it. It is more buying into a stabler asset that might have a better, that might end up having a better return because it's a better asset. I give you an example, and it's a true example. Let's say I had these two properties. One was in a kind of a BC neighborhood, but the return was great. It was a 15, 25, somewhere in between their IRR. Great return. The idea was we were buying an empty building. We were going to put tenants in it. We had tenants, according to the broker, lined up when we bought it, and it was going to be a great deal. And I had this other deal that, it was a good value add deal, but it was in a very high demand area, very wealthy area, a lot of traffic, limited supply of that sort of product. Well, the one that had the really good return, over COVID, the one that had the really good return, theoretically, we couldn't rent it. And the really good return became really not so good after a few years of it sitting vacant. The one that, looked like it had a lower return ended up always having a demand. So it was always full. And we never really had to worry about it not getting any income. It was more a matter of how much higher is the income going to be year after year. So that's the position. Another position, financial position, is leverage. A lot of people buy, they tout buying zero down. Well, then you have a huge mortgage to pay. I mean, I understand that coming up with money, putting money down is very, it's not easy. But one example, and this is a true example, and I write about it in my book, we had a, and maybe I shouldn't name the tenant, it's a corporate tenant, very big. During COVID, not during COVID, this was before COVID, they made a corporate decision that they wanted to save money and lower rents, lower the rents and muscle the landlords. Well, they came to us and they said, okay, our lease is finishing. They had a right, an option to, extend, but their initial lease is a retail financial institution. They said, well, we're going to move out if you don't lower the rent by 25%. Now, the issue is that a lot of landlords, they have a huge mortgage to pay. And in retail, you don't, it's not, even if you have a great location, typically a tenant moves out, you don't have somebody ready to move in that's ready to pay rent day one. Usually it takes 6 months. It could take 2 or 3 years sometimes to get a tenant. If you have, and to like sign a lease to get the property producing income. If you have a huge mortgage, you're going to be having to carry the cost of that mortgage until you generate income. So a lot of landlords were unable to negotiate the rents higher because they didn't want to be stuck in a position where the property would be sitting for a year without, more or less, a year without being able to pay for its own mortgage. And we didn't have a mortgage on our property. So when they came to us and they tried to muscle us, we were like, no, go fly a kite. We're not going to take less than what it's worth. If you don't want to move out, I'm sorry, if you don't want to stay, then we'll find somebody else. And that's the position. We didn't have to worry about our mortgage. It was a great location. We didn't have to worry about finding a new tenant. We could hold on to it for a year. There was no mortgage to pay. There's property taxes and there's other expenses, but the mortgage payment was, tends to be one of the payments that really kills people. I mean, if there's one solution, and it's probably 60% of the problems that people have in owning real estate, it's, covering the expense of the mortgage. So it's just positioning financially there where, it builds strength in having it. People sometimes, I like to compare, people bragging of about assets under management. I own $100 million of assets. Maybe that's a lot, but it's just maybe they only have $5 million in equity in those assets, and they're very volatile, and they could lose them tomorrow. I would rather own $10 million worth of assets, and have them free and clear than $100 million where I could lose them tomorrow. I mean, these are big numbers, but lower or higher, the principle is that you have a position that is more stable, that is more grounded, that long term you can depend on it and it'll be there.
What do you think when it comes to location, urban, suburban, rural? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Ooh, that thoughts. It's funny. I have a lot of thoughts on that. I wrote a chapter in my book. It's a little bit lengthy. It's about trends. Everything changes so fast, and there's so many different things to look at. And it's nearly impossible, I think, to look at all the trends that are happening. And to answer that question, I mean, you have to understand the trends. I like urban. I like, to me, you have to understand the nature of what you're getting into. I talk about Carmel by the Sea as an example because it's just a great case study. It's a city that is 1 mile square. There's three blocks of retail. There's a lot of household income in the area, and there's no supply that's going to be added. I don't know if it would be urban, but it's a great position. Urban can be good. A lot of the properties that I've been involved with are in great urban areas. But so I think I like urban. Rural, it's funny you say that because I am looking at buying some land in Colorado right now, and to do some developments there. The thing is, you just have to understand where there's traffic, where there's going to be demand, access, just like in sales, in real estate, access and location matters. So if you're close to people and you give them what they're looking for, what's in demand, then I think it's much safer, and it's even if you pay a little bit more for it or a lot more for it, sometimes it's a lot. That's how I feel about that. I love the idea of going out and building something, but that's far from urban centers, but it tends to be a lot riskier.
What about geographic location, Eduardo?
It's if we're talking about residential or retail, industrial is a little bit different. See, I don't do industrial, and I have a lot of respect for people that do. And it's funny because insurance companies used to focus on it because it was so simple. But to limiting the answer to question of residential, retail, and maybe office, I think geographical location matters.
Do you favor West Coast over Midwest, East Coast? Are there particular areas that you think are a better starting point or a better middle point or areas that have a better return on investment?
Well, that depends on each investment. I like, so you live in Florida. I love Florida. I think it's a great state. I love the nature there. I think the entry points of real estate are a lot, they might seem high, but you know, compared to California, where the average house is, I think, $950,000, it's a lot. It's easier to, I think, find something there that's a lower barrier capital wise to get into. No, basically, I'm answering your question without giving you an answer. No, I think you have to know the nature of the place that you're investing in. You know, we've looked all over. We have properties in Hawaii and Texas and California. We've looked in Florida. I wouldn't say that there's a preference. There's more a management style and what we're looking at and what we know. But no, I mean, if it's a good location, good market, then it's attractive. You know, there's more dependability there. So I wouldn't say that there's a preference.
How
You know,
important is it for you to be near your investment? Should you buy within a certain radius of where you can easily reach the property? Certainly, as a starting investor, how important is that?
To answer that question, generally, yes, it's important to be close. I would say it's important to be close. And especially if you're learning, if you want to buy more real estate, understanding what's going on with that real estate, I think makes a difference. I want to caveat that with, I mean, it's not always true. You know, the McDonald's that I was looking for my uncle's, it was in Augusta, right by, you know, the golf course where the Masters is. That you don't need to be close. You know, it's like a bond. You buy it, you own the real estate, you rent it out. Retail is, you know, the nature of retail is super different. A lot of the work is done up front. You have a tenant, and then you're pretty much sitting on your hands until the lease is up. So, not saying it's not a lot of work. It's a lot of work. It's just all up front. So that kind of investment, you don't really need to be close to it. You know, you need to get it leased, but you hire the right broker, you understand the market, you drive around the area, you know, you see what's going on, if there's new developments, what kind of tenants are being, you know, are moving in, moving out, that sort of thing. Knowing the laws, you know, do they allow drive-throughs suddenly in the city? Because that happened during COVID. They kind of changed the laws in certain places for drive-throughs. You know, and that helps because that could add a lot of value to your property and you want to be aware of it. But you don't need to be close to it all the time. If you have a triplex and that's your only investment, you probably are not going to pencil, you know, a property management company to come manage the property. That's very hands-on. So, I mean, that's how, you know, my son, I used to sometimes Fridays, I remember I'd have to wake him up at 1 in the morning Friday to fix a plumbing issue because, you know, somebody clogged their toilet. And I had to be close for that reason. But to me, maybe because I kind of like to get in, I like to know being close does help. And you do tend to see trends a lot clearer when you're close. It's not a must. And it depends on what it is.
What role does diversification play, geographic or in type of real estate, in the price of the real estate? How important is it to have diverse investments in your, eventually in your portfolio?
I would say medium. I mean, that might be a strange answer, but you know, from my podcast, I interview a lot of very successful real estate people, and you know, some of them focus only on co-living in Southern California, and they're experts at it. I mean, they kick butt. They've done very well. Some people literally have categories of real estate that they own that I didn't even, you know, hear about before I interviewed them. I didn't even know that, you know, it was smart to diversify that much. I mean, we're talking about like 10 different categories: senior housing, affordable living, hospitality, residential, condo build outs, apartments, you know, everything. And they're all successful. I don't know if diversification is an important thing to focus on for everybody. If you have a specialty, I think that could give you a huge competitive advantage. The guy that I was talking about that does only co-living in Southern California, his competitive advantage is construction in Southern California with these types of assets. He just knows how to build and he fills them up, and that he doesn't have diversification, but it works. And I would say it's pretty stable because, it's co-living in Southern California. People are not gonna, the population growth is not necessarily a huge problem. And it's not gonna change dramatically, over like lower in a long-term sort of time horizon. The problem with diversification, is you really have to learn a lot about a lot. Because if you're doing hospitality, let's say, you really have to understand the trends and how people are spending their money. Hospitality, hotels, people, it tends to be more disposable income. Well, what's happening with taxes? What's happening with the economy? What's happening with people's spending habits? Are people traveling? If they are, where? Carmel by the Sea, again, it's another city that people tended to really like during COVID, because if they were traveling internationally, maybe they wouldn't. They'd stay local, and that was a city that a lot of people went to. So that's just hospitality. And let's say now you have an apartment building in Oklahoma, where a lot of it is a lot of the employment base is oil related, Devon Energy and Chesapeake. Well, let's say Chesapeake has a huge lawsuit and they're laying people off left and right. Well, now that ch so now you have to know the how what's happening there with the employment base, and it becomes a lot more to juggle. You have people like Warren Buffett, who I think 85% of his stock holdings are in like three or four companies. Ray Dalio talks about diversification. He's, I think, Bridgewater Capital, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, hedge fund in the world. Talks about how, diversification is, how low diversification is uncorrelating your risk as much as possible in your investments. And, that's a very good way to put it. It depends how much correlation you want.
If you have figured out all of these investment strategies for real estate, isn't writing the book and sharing the information here on your podcast a little bit like giving away the goose that weighs the golden eggs?
I feel that this, I think, first off, I think if people understood how to make decisions this way differently, I think the world kind of needs to, I don't want to sound, arrogant. The mindset in real estate had a lot of flaws, and I hate to see people who have worked 30, 40 years on building their life savings lose it during every cycle. And I don't want, maybe not every cycle, but it's very easy to look at the 2008, recession. The middle class loses. It's not the, the big corporations. They tend to get bailed out, or they tend to, come back on top. But when you spend 35 years, building a laundromat business, and you find some real estate and you sell your business so that your kids can have, some assets, and then you get wiped out because you just didn't know. Well, here's a book that'll help you know and will help you get into it. And will, I mean, these are lessons, this book, it's more of like a passion project. I wrote it to help people and to give people the right mindset. It's a no-brainer that interest rates are going to go up. But why didn't people think of that? It's because people are not in real estate all the time, and they don't see things happening, what the nature is. A lot of people love these crowdfunding platforms, and they invest in these real estate companies. What they don't realize is that they're literally giving their money to someone else who now has control of their money. And if they want their money back, they can't get it back because they're invested in a deal that they're not controlling. You know, it's these topics that, I mean, they might see that, you know, that the maybe the idea of the deal that they invested in was that they would sell the deal in 2 to 4 years, but maybe it doesn't get sold in 2 to 4 years. Maybe the manager of that fund decides to turn a condo project into rentals, and it's going to be rentals until the market picks back up, and then it'll be condos sold as condos. But they lost their nest egg. Not lost, they lost control of that money. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just being aware of these things so that you can make better decisions. That's what it's about. And no, I think that there's a lot of opportunities out there, and you know, I'm hoping to help, you know.
Some analysts say that there is a scarcity of residential real estate. Some analysts say that there is a glut of real estate, that there is new construction in record numbers. Some analysts say that the buyers have pulled out. Some analysts say that foreclosures are skyrocketing. What do you think is the state of the market right now?
That's what I was saying by the economists can be wrong 90% of the time. There's a lot of noise out there. I think that, and there's a lot of day-to-day noise out there. That's why, in a way, at some point, you got to ignore it because some of that noise is just noise and it's temporary. You know, the stock market went down 2% and then it went up 5%. It's, I don't think there's, that a lot of news is panickable. I think it's just to get your attention. But I mean, there's certain things that people have to pick what to pay attention to. You know, for me, the value of real estate from the 1980s has skyrocketed relative to wages and wage growth. And when you put those two and two together, you know, that's important to know, to see that, you know, the affordability of housing is a has become a big issue in the last 40 years. What are we going to do about that? Is that how are you going to position yourself so that, you know, you're not in trouble in the future? Those are important things to consider. But yeah, there is, you know, there's supposed to be, I think I remember last December they were talking about a $1.5 trillion worth of debt. They called it the wall of debt coming due. And yeah, I mean, I think that we are in a position where we, since COVID, since 2021, probably 20, even 2020, where we have overleveraged ourselves. So there is a bubble that's about to burst, and that's why the book is in a way more important now, just to be aware and to position properly. And I think there will be opportunities in the next, you know, 5 years, I'll say. I know that's a long time for, it sounds like a long time for some people, but there's a correction every 18.6 years from the bottom of the market. It's happened since 1770. There's cycles. Money was literally free, 0% interest rates for a while. In some countries, it was negative interest rates. It's a disaster, in my opinion, waiting to happen. I don't think necessarily recession is a bad word. I don't like to see people get hit. But you know, it's the recession is good for an economy, so is growth. It's like an organism breathing, you know, breathe in, breathe out. That's how it grows. And the recession, you just don't want to be in the way of it. And that is a good time, a lot of times, to get into real estate. A friend of mine started buying triplexes in 2008. First triplex he bought, put $5,000 on his credit card for the down payment, and you know, took out a small loan. And now he manages over $2.5 billion worth of assets, you know, real estate. Apartment buildings, industrial, things like that. And he started during the recession. So, you know, that's why positioning matters.
When do you think the market is going to reach the bottom? Where in what year will the trough arrive?
You know, that really has to do with what kind of government support we're going to have with different events. You know, right now I was watching this this news segment, and they were talking about how a lot of the delinquencies in the, you know, residential market, the mortgages, the banks are now working out those, you know, it's hard to answer that question because it depends what kind of solutions people have at the time, what kind of band-aids people are going to use until things happen. You know, during, I know I keep talking about COVID, during COVID, the government, you know, printed, I think, 40% of the money supply. They changed the supply, you know, of money out there. So that changes the timing of things. They gave a ton of stimulus money. Well, on top of that, that stimulus money changes a possible recession. It, you know, it's it really depends on what's going on and is it delayed. I think that for sure, and that's why I said 5 years, we're going to have some kind of major correction by 2029. 2029 sounds like a big number, you know, it sounds far away. But we might, I believe we're going to have a smaller correction by 2027. What usually happens is in this 18.6 cycle, year cycle, is that the first, you have 7 years of growth, you have a little correction, you have 7 more years of growth, and then that little correction usually lasts 4 years. And then you have a sudden like crash, you know, like in 1929, or, you know, major crashes. Like recession was in 2008. I don't, that wasn't a depression. I think we're due for a depression, you know, in 1929. And that's when there could be a lot of wealth taken out of, a lot of transfer of wealth, let's say.
Is there a profile of an ideal real estate investor based on what you're saying? It's not for everybody. It's not for people who want to show off. It's for people who are focusing on growth, if I understood from your book correctly. Are there characteristics that good real estate investors share in common?
Oh yeah, that's what I love about my podcast. You know, it's talk about rent control. You know, I was taught to never really get into rent control properties because the government controls the price. There's a lot of laws. You know, it's very difficult for a lot of reasons. I interviewed somebody who only does rent control, and all of his rationale made sense, and at the end of the day, it was the same one as the same type of rationale as the person who didn't do rent control in terms of making money, stability, increasing rent, increasing income. When somebody moves out, you know, what do you do? So there was a lot of similarities. I wouldn't say that there's a specific profile. I would say there's a specific strategy that everybody should be in real estate. You know, let's say you have a ton of capital, you know, and you want to put it in a security, meaning something stable, something that you don't have to manage a lot. That's going to be a certain type of profile. But let's say you don't have a lot of money. I think it's still good to get into real estate to have some, you know, you have all these pressures, inflation and things like that. You need to, I think people being financially independent to a certain degree, it's something everybody should look at. And you just have to, you know, execute the strategy according to what your needs might be. If you're 20 years old, it's going to be very different than if you're, you know, 55.
Where else can our listeners learn about real estate investing, resisting recession, how to build and preserve your real estate investments regardless of market conditions? Obviously, your book is one place. Is there anywhere else? Are there other books that you like, or websites, or influencers, anything that you would
Oh
recommend?
yeah. Yeah, Sam Zell wrote a book. I can't remember the name. Am I Talking Loud Enough? I think is the name of the book. Sam Zell was one of the greatest investors of all time. I mean, just the way he thought, he was very rebellious, but he recently died the last 3, 4 years ago. But the way he thought was great. He left his door open, he talked to everybody, kept his mind open, and his premise was everything was supply and demand. And if he felt that there was a value there that he can bring on something that was in demand that wasn't there, he would invest in it. And he did ex I mean, he was one of the Equity Residential, I think, was his company. But that he's reading that book is great. Yeah, there's all sorts of books. I read a lot of books on mindset, I guess, and so how to think. Let's see. The Hard Thing About Hard Things is good. There's this great book, and he talks about the 18-year cycle, called The Secret Life of Banking and Real Estate. And I can't remember. I think his name. Let me see if I could get his name real fast. It's an excellent book. Phil Anderson. Okay, he wrote a great book that was very educational, and that's where it goes back to the 1770, and he talks about, Confederate notes being very valuable, and then they lost their value, because of the there was a sudden recession. But that's another great book to read. Who else would I say is a good influencer or a good God, a lot of people would say Grant Cardone. I can't buy everything he's saying. Or Kiyosaki. I like Robert Kiyosaki a lot. My book, by the way, is written very similar to his in how I bring up stories, although my stories are real. I don't know how much of what he says is for selling his his materials versus making sense. But it's just what jewels do you pick out of where? Like he might have say some good things, he might say some nonsense. I think it's same with Grant Cardone. It's what do you get out of it, and what are you going to listen to? What are you going to value in what they say? They say a lot. So what things are going to be the right things to pick from what they said?
When you say what jewels, it makes me think of all this talk that we're hearing now about alternate investments such as precious metals and cryptocurrencies. What do you think in relation to those options vis-a-vis real estate? Is that a good mix? Should you be adding that? Is real estate the only place where you should put your money?
I don't like cryptocurrency. I know that I mean, I have friends that invest in it. My family, we invested in a little bit of it. I just there's no intrinsic value. And I've talked to a lot of people who've made a lot of money in it, and it just still doesn't make sense to me. And one of the things I said earlier, was don't invest in things you don't understand. I don't understand that. It's very hard for me to understand that. I understand supply and demand. I understand, a lot of the ways they try to explain it, but I think it's BS. And I also think it's a lot of it's a distraction. And I think a lot of people will lose a lot of money with this crypto stuff. Yeah, it might make some people very wealthy, but I feel like those people's wealth will disappear one day really easily, if they don't sell out. But sell their holdings. I could be wrong. I don't know. I don't want that, but I'm not comfortable with not knowing. It's made up in the air. I like writing with my pencil and a notepad. I'm old school like that. I don't, the crypto stuff is kind of digital. It's not, makes me trepidatious, I guess. And then the other thing was, what was the other question?
The other alternative is should be very much more comfortable because it's tangible. Well, could
Yeah.
be tangible, which is precious
Oh,
metals.
Yeah, no, I have gold. I think gold is one of the best assets, especially, you're taking out the, in a way, the inflation problem. It just doesn't do much. It doesn't give you back money. It just increases in value and it's very stable. To me, I know I talk about safety and position and this and that. I also value growth. I think that you have to be creating wealth in order to survive long term. I mean, just think about a family of five, three kids. Let's say husband and wife, they make a good nest egg. Well, as soon as they pass that down, now it's divided into three kids that each have their kids, and everybody has to increase their wealth so much in order to keep the level of wealth that they have. Precious metals, I don't see how they would do that. I think they're a good safety investment, but not a good growth investment.
So a hedge against inflation, but isn't that in a way what real estate does in some instances?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Real estate, in my opinion, is the best hedge against inflation.
Eduardo, thank you for joining us from Pebble Beach, California.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Elena. It's a pleasure chatting with you.
And to our audience, you have been listening to Eduardo Siegel, who is author of Resisting Recession: How to Build and Preserve Your Real Estate Investments Regardless of Market Conditions, who discussed how to master the real estate mindset. To propose a guest for the show, you can email me directly at editor@hispanicmpr.com. That's editor@hispanicmpr.com.